Monster Man, special episode, Hobgoblins. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. And in particular, of Patreon supporter John, who has asked me to talk about any monster from a previous episode that I felt like I could say more about. So in keeping with John's instructions, I've decided to talk about Hobgoblins. If you'd like to be like John and get your own special episode, and I guess in particular, if you'd like to be like John, get your own special episode and just tell me to do whatever I like, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to the rewards for lower levels, such as intermittent bonus content that I release every month at the $1 level, or at the $2 level, my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is all about the Deities and Demigod supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, and how to use religion and mythology more generally in your games. So John, thank you very much for your generosity. I'm really pleased that you're enjoying the show enough to want to support it, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Alright, so hobgoblins hold an unusual place in the kind of scaling orcish humanoid monster, what were once called giant type monsters of Dungeons and Dragons. So I'm talking here about monsters like orcs, goblins, kobolds, bugbears, gnolls, all that kind of thing. Goblins are tougher than kobolds, and orcs are tougher than goblins, and hobgoblins are tougher than orcs, and so on. All of that is fine, and it allows you to kind of fight goons with swords as your characters go up in level. But hobgoblins have a slightly different personality from the other types of kind of goblinoid, who are mostly what you would characterize as marauding barbarians. This owes a lot to their inspiration, who are, of course, the fighting Uruk-hai from The Lord of the Rings. And I don't want to go into the Uruk-hai in too much detail, because if there's one thing I've learned is that everybody knows more about Tolkien than I do. But essentially, the Uruk-hai are orcs, which is to say goblins, which is to say monstrous non-human creatures, who have become militarized. And prior to this point, orcs have been seen as kind of bully villains. Cruel and definitely dangerous, but also kind of cowardly and not very intelligent. They need to be kind of scaled up a little bit for the conflicts that are going to happen in the Lord of the Rings novels. Essentially, as the characters, not as they individually get more powerful, but as they emerge onto a national stage where like whole armies and nations are going to get involved, we have to have this army of orcs. And it fits that the Uruk-hai are the soldiers of Saruman, the sort of modernizing wizard, because the Uruk-hai are orcs who've been militarized, not just in their society and their culture, but also kind of physically. They've been altered in some way to make them better soldiers. They're not ideal soldiers, but they're better soldiers. And we see the Uruk-hai as, you know, braver, more disciplined, and maybe more technologically advanced than these sort of marauding hordes of orcs that appear at other times. I'm very sorry, by the way, if at any point in this episode I say hoblins. It's very hard for me to say hobgoblin over and over again. So in D&D, hobgoblins have kind of had this martial aspect played up. And because their art kind of takes its inspiration from, not completely from sort of Japanese armor, but I think that's definitely an influence there. They kind of had a bit of a samurai look in the first edition monster manual. I mean, not completely, but I think that the influence is there. This has gone on to sometimes give them a sort of something of a code of honor, which I don't think is present in their Tolkien inspiration. Now, the reason that I thought it would be fun to talk about hobgoblins is that they came up during the episode about the GIF. And the similarity between the hobgoblins and the GIF is that they're both military monsters. They're both very attached to a sort of not just warlike, but militaristic lifestyle. I think you could argue that the GIF are maybe a bit more of a positive spin on the military monster, and hobgoblins are maybe a bit more of a negative one. So the GIF like all the things, I mean, they like fighting too, but they also like the things that are sort of picturesque about the military, you know, fancy uniforms and marching and that kind of thing. You know, they don't just like combat. And they're presented in a way that's meant to make them kind of funny. You know, they're a bit, you know, maybe not the admirable aspects of the military, but the comic aspects of the military. By contrast, of course, hobgoblins are sort of the bad things that you can think of about not just the military, but about militarism. Now, I think that military enemies are interesting. In general, D&D fans, D&D players, gamers in general, often think about warfare, the military, and military history. And this is partly because adventure fiction draws on kind of elements that are present in military history. So, for example, thinking about weapons and armor. And it's also because many role players are also war gamers, right? You know, D&D has its roots, as everyone will tell you, in wargaming, although those people often have very funny ideas about what the influence of a wargame would be on D&D's rules. It's not detailed rules for combat. No wargame has combat rules as detailed as D&D. Well, modern D&D anyway. But all of those trappings overlap, but in general, D&D campaigns tend not to deal directly with war or with the military, because of course, ultimately, the power fantasy of heroic adventure stories is about individual agency, and if there's one thing that the military is not into, it's individual agency, right? War is a time of collective action. I always use the example of, I played the computer game Morrowind. I'm sure I've said this on the show before, but I played Morrowind many years ago. And in it, you can get certain quests by joining the Imperial military. And they give you this Imperial military armor. Well, I didn't put on the Imperial military armor because it wasn't as good as the armor that I already had. And so I joined the Imperial military, and then the first thing that happened was I got reprimanded for being out of uniform. And then the second thing that happened was, just in like a little passerby bit of dialogue, I got yelled at for being away from my post. Now, those are both very realistic things to happen in the military, I'm sure. You can't just go wherever you want and dress however you like when you're in the army. But it's not necessarily a lot of fun in a role-playing game context. So, warfare, although it sort of comes up a lot in fantasy literature, I think probably comes up less in D&D campaigns than we might otherwise expect it to. And I think that's a shame, because I think that there are particular challenges and particular scenarios that only really work in the context of a setting at war. And hobgoblins are one of those elements. The ideal way to use hobgoblins is to have the characters be in a war. Now, this could be because their kingdom has been invaded. It could be because they're invading somewhere else. It could be because to get to wherever they need to go to, they need to pass through an area where there's a war going on. A good example of this is Quelong, if that's how you pronounce it, by Ken Height, which sees the characters on a quest through a war-torn landscape, a magic war-torn landscape, for, you know, a magical doodad. So if the characters have to, you know, cross this landscape at war for their mission, then you can really use hobgoblins to their full extent. This works especially well because hobgoblins are a good example of a monster that, you know, maybe is most effective in very large numbers. A couple of hobgoblins make excellent guards, but, you know, once you get to a certain level, you're not too concerned about the threat of a hobgoblin. But even quite powerful characters who aren't up at the absolute tip-top of the level scale are probably not going to want to take on a battalion of 500 hobgoblins. You know, you can't just run up on them and expect to fight them, even if you're throwing fireballs. But at the same time, hobgoblins are sort of mortal creatures, and their behavior is predictable by thinking about what humans do. Hobgoblins need to rest, they need food, they need water, they need supplies, they travel in large numbers, they need protection, all that kind of stuff. So if you're trying to avoid hobgoblins in the landscape, you know, if you're trying to get around the hobgoblin patrols and make it to the castle where you can find the Blue Jewel, to evacuate it from the war-torn kingdom before the hobgoblins get it, then you can make predictions about what the hobgoblins are going to do based on what you know about them, based kind of on how you think real soldiers would act. You know, it's time to start caring about how far an army can march during in a particular day, which is probably not as far as a bunch of, you know, clever heroes can go. And hobgoblins are neither stupid nor brilliant, as a rule. So, you know, we can anticipate that they will make reasonable responses to the player character's actions, but maybe not like amazingly creative or tactically inspired ones. So I think that there are all kinds of situations that you can derive from the presence of hobgoblins that maybe you could get out of, you know, an army of orcs or an army of undead, but I think hobgoblins are maybe a little more flexible in this respect. So I like the idea of running into the evidence of the hobgoblins passing. So, you know, maybe for instance, you know, you're headed for a particular town and along the way you run into, you know, waves of refugees from the town intermingled with the broken remnants of the army that was defending it, and you discover that the hobgoblins have taken it. And you know that they're probably, like, sacking it right now. I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to stay here and help the refugees? Are you going to race to the town to try and, whatever it is, get across the river or rescue the mayor or you get the sacred relics out of the cathedral? You know, whatever it is, the idea of, like, a city being pillaged, I think that's a like a cool environment for a scenario, but also the task of like trying to protect a refugee column. You know, how can you do that when there's only a few of you? You know, what you'd have to do some kind of creative thinking to do that. I like the idea of a siege. Fortresses under siege are really interesting because they put you in this kind of pressure cooker environment. It is an area of warfare where individual agency can wind up being really important. Because while it might be hard for a besieging army to break into a fortress, it might be easier for someone to infiltrate it or negotiate with the people in it. All kinds of shenanigans could be happening in the castle, right? I always, you know, because I'm interested in the First Crusade, my example of this is always the Siege of Antioch, which is ultimately ended when an officer in the defending army betrays the city to the besiegers. I like the idea that the hobgoblins' predictable movements force the player characters to use areas that people don't go, right? So if you're being pursued by, you know, when we think of hobgoblins, your typical hobgoblin soldier is some kind of heavy infantry. We're talking about armored troops using, you know, spears and shields or maybe pole arms, and they probably are going to like to stick to relatively flat areas, to roads, to valleys, and so you're going to have to go up into kind of the wild places, into woods and hills and places like that to escape their notice. You know, doubly so if you're trying to get away from, I assume they have some kind of, you know, outriding cavalry patrols. This becomes a reason why the player characters are in the kinds of out-of-the-way places where adventures happen, because they've been driven there by the fact that the hobgoblins are occupying all the places that are easy to travel through. So hobgoblins are essentially your war monster. If you want a monster, there's no reason you couldn't be fighting humans instead of hobgoblins, but I think that the hobgoblin adds a sort of image of horror to it. This raises the question of how much of the suffering of war do you want in your role-playing game? I talked about, you know, refugees and broken armies. I don't know how much, like, I don't know how long my group would spend in that environment, you know, before there comes a point when, you know, one of the reasons that we like heroic fantasy adventures where individual agency matters is that they're fun. So you have to make a decision before the war starts about how much of the suffering of war you want on screen. You also need to think about how much your players care about the military strategy aspect of things. Because if you are, you know, a high-level fighter or something like that, then chances are that, you know, you could be kind of pressed into service as some kind of officer, right? And again, that could be fun if you are the kind of player who enjoys that. To have NPCs come and say, oh, you know, thank goodness you've come, Sir So-and-so. A knight of your experience will be a great asset to us in our war against the hobgoblins. And the fighter's like, well, I would help, but the Blue Jewel. So you can have that conflict. And when you do get involved, I think some players really enjoy the whole bit with, like, the little markers on the map. Particularly if you have an actual map and actual markers. I think, you know, pushing the little colored blocks around the map is a lot of fun. And they can, you know, they get to kind of, like, tap the map and be like, well, it seems to me that there's a weakness in the Hobgoblin's lines right here. You know, but that's what they want you to think. Kind of stuff. But some players tune out because it's impersonal. It loses some of the things that make typical D&D adventure more interesting. So I think you have to be a little bit cautious in terms of including kind of grand strategy elements. Though I think most players will put up with it for a session or two, and some players will enjoy it being a regular feature of the game. I do think that people appreciate, you know, a little bit of that evolving narrative. So where like the situation is changing continually, that can be fun. So, you know, where a messenger runs in to breathlessly report that, you know, Lord Xurgathrax has left Fort Skullrender with 10,000 hobgoblins and is marching on the capital. Well, okay, that's good, you know. Now that raises the question whether you want to have the PCs fight a battle. And again, a battle is an example of something that, you know, is dramatic and exciting, but maybe doesn't afford all that much opportunity for individual action. I think the solution to the battle is to pull the old Bernard Cornwell. Not so much the later Last Kingdom Bernard Cornwell, but more of the Sharp Bernard Cornwell, which is that the protagonist is in a battle, but there is simultaneously some secondary objective that he has to achieve. I think when you do that, it can be very effective because the battle provides an exciting, action-packed backdrop to the secondary, or really primary, plot. And he still has to stay alive and fight all these hobgoblins. Hobgoblins also have this huge advantage. I mean, I realize that up to this point, I've just been talking about war. The thing is that hobgoblins are, unlike many other monsters, regular soldiers. And what that means is that they solve the Tucker's Kobolds problem. I had a whole episode about Tucker's Kobolds, and I think I didn't articulate the point I was making as clearly as I could, which is this. In Tucker's Kobolds, the kobolds are the ones having fun. The kobolds are the Ewoks, and the player characters are the stormtroopers. But the stormtroopers are boring and bad, and the Ewoks are fun and clever and creative. So having an opponent that uses rigid discipline and predictable tactics and brute force allows the player characters, if they're going to be out brute forced, to beat their enemies using trickery and innovative strategy and traps and misdirection and sabotage and all of that fun stuff. Nobody wants to play the lumbering oaf getting tricked and trapped and shot at by the scrappy underdog. We want to play the scrappy underdogs. And hobgoblins provide a perfect example of this because they're a credible threat. And so watching a bunch of them go blundering into your pitfall is much more satisfying than the, like, when you do eventually get past all the Tucker's Kobold's death traps and you catch up to the kobolds and smack them with your Glibquiz arm, you feel like a bully because they're just kobolds. But if you mislead a bunch of hobgoblins into an ambush and then you jump them, kill them, take their armor, infiltrate the camp, steal all their mules, that is rewarding in a way that beating up a bunch of kobolds is not. And so the hobgoblins have the perfect combination of disciplined kind of by-the-book regularity and brute strength that you can do all this stuff and have it be satisfying in a way that it wouldn't necessarily be with some other types of monster. Now, you can add a level of moral complexity if you choose certain answers to the question of what is a hobgoblin. So in my old D&D campaign, hobgoblins were a genetically engineered soldier species. Most of the different species were essentially like created variants of a few core ones. Initially, half-orcs had been created. Half-orcs were not the offspring of a human and an orc. They were a stable species. I just called half-orcs because that's kind of where the donor genes came from. And they were created by the elves to be a soldier species, the idea being that they would be as strong and ferocious as an orc, but as disciplined and intelligent as a human. And they were essentially phased out in favor of the hobgoblins. So half-orcs were kind of this abandoned experiment trying to find their own place in the world. And then they had in turn been replaced by these, you know, indoctrinated, militarized hobgoblins. Another idea is that the hobgoblins are not physically particularly different, or they are, but they're not a different species from other types of goblinoid. They're merely the military elite of a goblin culture. So hobgoblin is more of an identity than a species. That regular little goblin dwelling in a cave and hunting giant spiders and, you know, concealing silver pieces in a boot, that's just a regular goblin, and then, like, the biggest and the strongest and the most warlike form into these military units, and they're essentially a kind of, you know, fighting elite of goblinoid society, while all these lesser goblins are essentially their kind of peasants and servants. And the third is that hobgoblin is essentially, like GIF, a military identity, but they're a bit more kind of like the Foreign Legion. So, in fact, some hobgoblins are bugbears, and some hobgoblins are half-orcs, and some hobgoblins are whatever. They all kind of join into these, a bit sort of like free companies, right? That they essentially become this kind of mercenary identity, and subscribing to this hobgoblin philosophy of drill and of tactics is what makes you a hobgoblin. Now, that may all seem a little complicated, but essentially the sort of stock description of all the different humanoid monsters in D&D has kind of fossilized into each species of goblinoid having exactly one personality. And their personality changes from time to time. Kobolds became more lovable. Goblins have become more lovable and more kind of like childlike and mischievous. Orcs sometimes become Klingons, kind of noble, savagey. But in general, I don't like the idea of a species that has a single personality. And this can raise questions of their agency, right? I mean, if you are looking at sort of the fighting Uruk-hai, their status as militarized warlike aggressors, that is something that was done to them. You know, is there a question of agency, or are we going to do the Star Wars thing and kind of make it clear that, you know, stormtroopers are human beings who can make moral choices and then just, you know, gun them down like dogs every time we see them and forget about it? Or is that not the kind of thing that we want in our games, right? There's some sympathy for the hobgoblin is a perfectly valid response. The other thing is that, you know, if this is going to be the fantasy 30 Years War or whatever, and, you know, hobgoblins are fanning out across the innocent villages of the kingdom they're invading, burning and plundering and murdering, you know, maybe your players aren't going to want to care too much about the individual moral agency of hobgoblins. Or indeed, maybe the fact of that moral agency is what condemns them. They could have stayed in caves putting silver pieces in a boot, and instead they're out here chasing a farm around the field with a spontoon. Nobody invited you to peaceful Kingdomia. So those are my thoughts about hobgoblins, which are really more a series of thoughts about war in fantasy RPGs and how hobgoblins are the ideal monster for those kinds of conflicts. John, I hope that you enjoyed it, even though you didn't ask for it specifically. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like John, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Next week, we'll be returning to Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for basic Dungeons & Dragons. So I hope that you'll all join me then for another episode of Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.